This is Jim Fetzer with my very special guest today, Carolyn Yeager, who has a wide variety of interests, political, economic, historical, and otherwise. She's a resident of Texas, and she's been catching up with the show and caught me with some typing during the program. So I want everyone to know that I have been reprimanded, and I'm going to take it to heart and try to do better. Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Fetzer. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wind up occasionally corresponding with my producer via chat when he's giving me, you know, some pointers or whatever. And I think sometimes it has just slipped my mind that it's going out there into cyberspace.
Well, that's understandable.
Carolyn, I know one of the topics we want to discuss and revolves around the Holocaust. I had a recent conversation with Gordon Duff, and I made that correction to the his name on the website for the Real Deal archives, in which I observed that laws against Holocaust denial are simply absurd, because if you believe in the reality of the Holocaust, as I do, then you know that serious research is going to substantiate that belief, and if it doesn't, then we're certainly all entitled to know.
Very good. That's very good sound thinking on your part. And this is exactly the the position of the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, which is the sponsor of my website about Elie Wiesel and his tattoo. So their position is simply, let's talk about it. Why can't we talk about it? See, it says open debate because we can talk about it in the United States. We have still have our First Amendment and free speech, but it's you can't really talk about it openly because immediately you will be hit upon by a whole onslaught of people who will attack you for wanting to talk about it.
But what does free speech mean? What does freedom of speech mean, Carolyn, if we can't talk about controversial subjects? I mean,
well, here's the interesting thing, Dr. Fetzer. You can talk about every controversial subject except this one.
And why is that? Well, see, it seems so completely ridiculous, you know?
Well, it's been going on for a long time. But people are so convinced by, first they're convinced that it's all real, just as they said it was. And so they say, you know, and then that's one way that they're convinced. But they still might say, well, but if people want to talk about it, let them talk about it. But the Holocaust industry and the Jewish element has made a very, very successful effort to say and convince people that it hurts them. It hurts the survivors. It hurts people terribly to have people expressing doubt about it or to question any of the details about it. And so, therefore, it should not be allowed. And they have succeeded in causing people or making people go along with that.
Well, I'll tell you, when I was a young man growing up in Southern California in the 50s, we used to have a free kids show at the Rialto Theater in South Pasadena, where I went to junior high and high school. And in the old days, of course, you had a cartoon, you had a newsreel, you know. I don't remember the previews of coming attractions, but I sure remember the newsreels because...
I do, too. they made a big impression.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I saw newsreels of massive bodies, you know, all these naked bodies being stacked up and tossed around like kindling in these death camps. Now, when I was...
Yeah, I didn't see those. I remember newsreels, but I never saw any of that stuff.
Oh, I saw it. It was really quite stunning stuff. And then when I was 15, my parents had made a trip to Europe, and they'd seen all these young people doing youth hostels and all that on bicycles. So they encouraged me to do that. So I saved money, and one of my uncles chipped in. It was going to cost $1,000 bucks, and I had to earn my part of it and managed to put it together. And I wound up being in a group with a Student International Travel Association that went to England, Belgium, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and France on bicycles. We actually sold our bikes in Switzerland and took a train across France to Paris. But when we were in Germany, the one and only day that I was under the weather. As I recall, we were in Heidelberg. It might have been Munich, but I think it was Heidelberg. And there was a side trip to Dachau. And I did
Dachau.
I did not go to that concentration camp because, but I have always wished that I had, so I could have seen for myself whatever there was to see. My fellow cyclists came back. I mean, I guess I was the youngest at 15, and the oldest was a 32-year-old secretary from Ann Arbor. But there were about 16 of us, and the other 15 all made the trip, and they came back with all the stories of the crematoria and all that. And I certainly, at that point in time, had no idea that this would ever become an issue of, public debate or skepticism. And, of course, we see all these amazing films like Schindler's List and Sophie's Choice and all that that tend to carry a tremendous emotional weight. So, you know, I've always myself been open-minded as a general attitude because I'm a professional philosopher and, you know, I just believe and you have to consider all possible hypotheses and relate them to the evidence to sort out what's true from what's false. But I've just been astonished by the extent to which, I mean, that Germany would pass a law that would incarcerate someone if they denied the Holocaust just is beyond me. I mean, I just can't imagine any possible rationale for having such an attitude. Unless, as you're implying, it's actually on the order of a myth or a dogma, in which case maybe scientific research is going to tend to undermine the legitimacy of the myth or dogma, and it's going to lose its potency as a political weapon.
Well, it already has done that. Scientific inquiry has already undermined the legitimacy of the Holocaust as it's presented. And because of that, that's why they have these prison sentences. Well, in 1986, you probably know the name of Ernst Sundel.
Yes.
He's famous. I suppose there are people who've never heard of him, but many people, most of them, the media made him very well known. And he was publishing some things. He didn't write anything, but he published a book about questioning the number 6 million. And it had some other questions in there, too. And then some organizations got upset about it, and they managed to get him, get some charges against him for inciting hatred into the masses or so on. And this was in Canada. And Canada has had some laws. Canada doesn't have a First Amendment freedom of speech like we have, but they think they have freedom of speech. Well, he went into court, and he had enough money, and he managed to get people to give him money also. And he put on a very good defense. And during his defense, a man named Fred Leuchter went over to Germany and went to Auschwitz, Birkenau, and went into the so-called gas chambers there. Took samples from the wall because based on his knowledge, he was an expert in execution and so on. Based on his knowledge, Zyklon B, which was the method of killing in these alleged gas chambers, leaves a blue stain on the walls where it's used, if it's used a lot, because it's made up of some kind of cyanide, potassium cyanide, or some kind of cyanide.
Yeah, well, there's going to be a chemical residue.
Yeah, and he took all these samples, and of course, the only places where there was a lot of blue stain were on the known rooms where disinfection was going on, disinfection of clothing and mattresses, and so personal items and so on. But in the so-called gas chambers, where supposedly people were being gassed, there was none of this stain. And this they thought this would be really be the it would really end the, this would really do it. They had terrific evidence here. Well, at the same time at this trial, they still were allowed to question the witnesses, cross examination of witnesses.
Sure.
And so these witnesses for the old Holocaust stories, the survivors who had written books and so on, they were cross-examined by the Zundel's attorneys, and every one of them was just brought to, you know, where their testimony was destroyed. And on top of that, a very famous historian, Raul Hilberg, came on the stand to support the prosecution, I guess you'd say. Or maybe the defense called him. I don't know. But he was questioned on his statements in his book that there was an order from Adolf Hitler to murder Jews in these gas chambers at this via the Wannsee conference, that whole business. And he was forced to admit that he couldn't produce any order, that he said there were orders, but he didn't have any, there weren't any. And therefore he ended up rewriting his famous book, you know, The Destruction of European Jews, and taking that out. And then he said from there on, he changed it to, well, there was a meeting of minds. It was unspoken, but everybody understood what they were supposed to do. And so they did it. Well, this was supposed to be a big blow. And Wiesel was exonerated. You know, charges were dropped against him or whatever. He won it. But they didn't give up. And, you know, because the media does not cover this kind of thing. Because the media will continue with their same old story about the Holocaust. And from then on, it was not allowed to cross-examine witnesses.
You said you mentioned the name of Wiesel. Did you meet Zundel? Who prevailed in the case? I mean,
Zundel. Yes,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for correcting.
Yeah. Because we hadn't got up to Elie Wiesel yet. But Well, I have a friend who in London I only met during a symposium I just participated in the UK, which was devoted to debunking the war on terror, where Ken O'Keefe from the Freedom Flotilla, who had disarmed several of the Israeli commandos, was our master of ceremonies, and I presented a talk on whether the wars in Iraq...
I'm aware of that, and you were there with Kevin Barrett and
Gillian Otzman. Yeah, that's right. And it was very interesting. I mean, you know, we hoped for a large turnout from the Islamic community, which did not occur. But we did tape it. We're turning it into two DVDs. And I hope it's going to reach a very large audience by that route. But while I was there, I visited with a friend I'd interviewed before on my show, who actually had lost an academic position because he had questioned the Holocaust. And to me, this is just absolutely unjust. It's irrational, and it's completely objectionable. And I just can't understand why a university of all places, which should champion freedom of thought and freedom of inquiry on all subjects, regardless, would take such a step. I mean, to me, it was
Universities have changed.
Disgraceful.
You are a true academic from the tradition of that, you know, academics should be in, but you must be aware that universities have really changed. They've become very politically correct, and that political correctness, well, I'm going to say it again. I know it doesn't sound good, but the number of Jewish academics has increased quite a bit over the years, and there are many universities and departments and universities that are really under the control of these Jewish members, professors and heads of departments and so on. And they really come down on this kind of thing.
Well, offer some general reflections here. I published a book on the evolution of intelligence in 2005. And during the course of that research, I explored racial differences in intelligence, which are an evolutionary phenomenon. And it turns out that the group that historically has had the highest levels of intelligence happens to be Jewish. And, of course, if you look through the history of science and technology, you find that, you know, Jews have made some of the most important, magnificent contributions to art and literature and science and technology. Einstein, Freud, Leonardo.
But let me interject, though, in my opinion, some of these may not have been as deserved as they have been made out to be, and that they are given the benefit of all of this attention. Well, they make that claim, and it's not as good as they make out to be. But Carolyn,
I have a PhD in the history of science and the philosophy of science, and I'll just tell you that in my judgment, it is a fact that there has been, many of the most important achievements in the history of science have come from persons who happen to be Jewish, but. I also really only introduced it because I think that there's a tendency among more highly intelligent people to get involved in higher education and to have academic positions. So, I mean, the idea, and this was the point.
That's true, but once they do, they then give more and more positions to fellow Jews. I think that can be demonstrated.
Well, that's an interesting sociological claim. I'll just say... During the history of my career, from 1970 to 2006, a 35-year period during which I taught mostly courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning at a wide variety of institutions of higher learning, including Kentucky, Virginia twice, Cincinnati, North Carolina, Chapel Hill, New College of the University of South Florida, and eventually the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota, I did not witness that. I mean, I'm not saying... what you're claiming is false, but it would be, of course, an empirical issue to investigate and determine the statistics. I'll just say none of that was obvious to me. Now, it wouldn't surprise me at all if in certain areas like New York City, that there was a superabundance of persons who happen to be Jewish, in a high political positions. Yeah. But in
Harvard.
Maybe
California colleges.
Take some persuading. I'll just say, listen, I spent my life in higher education, and I'm more of an expert. I'm saying it never arose. Faculty talk about everything, okay? Among themselves, whether or not they're willing to take a public stand on controversial issues, they talk about all subjects among themselves, and I cannot recall a single conversation in 35 years at all these institutions and conferences and everything else that ever, where that issue ever arose. And it seems to me if it were a bona fide issue, it would have. I mean, I'm talking about, 35 years. I mean,
Okay.
I had a lot all right. of
well, in all of this time, did they, amongst all these faculty talking among themselves, did they ever talk about the Holocaust?
It would come up occasionally. And then, I think that there'd be a strong tendency to agree with me that laws against Holocaust denial are simply absurd. I mean, they're immoral. They're not just intellectually offensive. They're immoral.
What would happen, Dr. Fetzer, if you were still, if you weren't retired, and you came out and started speaking, saying that publicly?
Mind you, Carolyn, I do my homework, right? I'm not going to address a topic unless I've done a lot of research on it and am convinced of what I'm saying and can produce support the evidence that substantiates my views, as I've done in the case of research on JFK, research on the death of Paul Wellstone, research on 9/11. I would have a considerable distance to travel in terms of doing research on the Holocaust to put me in a position where I would make such arguments. But if I were in that position, I mean, my tendency is to say my piece. I tend not to mince words. And if I believe the Holocaust were a fraud, I think it's highly probable, given who I am, that I'd be saying so and saying so in public fora. And probably, I wouldn't be surprised if I would get a raft of criticism. But, as I say, if I were to be in the position of doing that, it would only be because I'd done all this homework, and then I would adduce the evidence that substantiates my position. I was very troubled about these studies about the chemical residue in the gas chambers not substantiating the use of Zyklon B. That's very, very troubling. If I had done that research myself or were more familiar with it, then it might inspire me to do more research. But, as it is, I have my hands full with JFK 9/11 and Paul Wellstone. I certainly like to explore additional issues through the radio show, for example, and articles I publish and so forth. But, So, you know, I mean, I'm very glad to have you on and others who have unconventional views like Gordon Duff and a host of others. I mean, in my opinion, there's no point in discussing issues if they're simple or uncontroversial. Therefore, I am drawn to those that are complex and controversial. I mean, those are the only ones worth discussing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here we are.
Yes. Yeah, I guess I'm the same in that regard.
Your point about Elie Wiesel is very peculiar, though, because, you know, he, of course, is perhaps the most well-known Holocaust survivor in the world. And yet he's asked about his tattoo, because that's how all the inmates were identified, by their tattoo, by their number. And he seems not to have one. Is that the case?
Yes. Yes, that's the strong suspicion, because we have photographs of his arm, and there are more photographs on the where it says on the page there under the on the page that is titled "Where is the tattoo?" There is more photographs, and there's no tattoo visible there. So where is it? And he's been asked about it. He always says he has one.
Why doesn't he show it?
He won't. He always refuses to do so.
Well, listen, I thought they were all on the forearm. So here we're looking at his forearm. I thought it was in the inside of the left arm. And here we're looking at his left arm. And it's not apparent. If it's there, it's not apparent.
I believe that they were on the outside of the
outside. Well, that would probably make more sense.
Many people think they're on the inside. And you see a lot of people showing tattoos on the inside. So it's still a little bit confusing. But it's definitely on the left forearm. And a lot of people have had tattoos put on them, which aren't official tattoos. So you have to be careful what you're looking at. But anyway, it's pretty well confirmed by revisionists that they did tattoo the people in Auschwitz, not the ones who just came and left and went somewhere else right away, but the ones who stayed there. And that they had a whole system of numbers, and it's known what it is. And so here we have Wiesel, plus the fact, Dr. Fetzer, that the number that Wiesel says belongs to him is documented by the Auschwitz and Buchenwald archives to have belonged to a man of the same name who was born 13 years earlier than him, anyway, in 1913. We have the testimony of another survivor who can prove that he was a survivor, who says that he knew this other Lazar Wiesel. He was a friend of his, and that he never knew this Elie Wiesel. And he says Elie Wiesel took this man's, his friend's identity and his tattoo number and even his book that he says this other man originally wrote, the book that Knight was taken from. That Elie Wiesel says he wrote that original book in Yiddish. It gets complicated, but I am uncomplicating it on this website, which is, if I might mention to your listeners, is at www.eliewieseltattoo.com. And the name of the website is Elie Wiesel Cons the World. So it's easy to just Google it.
And remember, spelling tattoo, there are two T's.
Yeah, two T's.
T-A-T-T-O-O-S. Actually, you might have heard me typing because I was going under concentration camp tattoos just to see if they showed, you know, the information about where they were imprinted. It says, prisoners from several transports in 43 had their numbers tattooed on the inner side of their left upper forearms.
See, but it wasn't upper.
Tattooing.
See, this is where you get lots of...
Yeah,
false
upper, right. I would have thought it was a lower. I mean, near your wrist, closer to your wrist, not your shoulder.
No, it wasn't above the elbow. It was below the elbow.
Right,
but,
below the elbow.
This is it where you look this up and you have to figure out what you're looking at.
Oh, I agree.
Even the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum puts out lots of false information. So they're not authoritative because they're pushing their agenda. It's all part of the, if you have any respect for Norman Finkelstein, it's all part of this Holocaust industry, which wants to continue on and grow no matter what, you know. So truth is not important.
Well, this is very embarrassing. If someone as prominent as Elie Wiesel actually doesn't have the bona fides, isn't the person he claims to be, that's really quite stunning.
Well, it is. And what's more is that he continues to be protected. And no matter what is said by, and this is not the first time, Elie Wiesel has been considered to be a fraud by many, many people over the years. But they're not people who count, you know, as to, if you are somebody who counted and you said that, you'd soon not count anymore. Because he is one of their mainstays. They've given him the Nobel Peace Prize, and he upholds the Holocaust, official Holocaust story. And you can compare this, Jim, you can compare this to your 9/11 conspiracies, Jim, yes, to all of these things. They all function the same way, don't they?
Carolyn, you know, this wouldn't be the only time that a Nobel Peace Prize had been given to someone who, I mean, if what you're suggesting is true, was undeserving. I mean, look at the Peace Prize being given to Barack Obama, who seems to be taking his bloody time getting us extricated from these wars in the Middle East that were launched in violation of international law, the UN Charter, and even the U.S. Constitution.
Either the Nobel Committee doesn't know what it's doing anymore, or it's just become so politicized. Because then we also had Henry Kissinger and,
God,
and was it Rabin who won one with the other, winning, I mean.
Kissinger's a particularly strange choice, since he may have been responsible for more deaths in the modern times than any other single individual.
Right. So people are really losing their faith in the Nobel Prizes.
No, I'm intrigued.
The other ones that, like you were talking about, you know, the scientific and all those, I think those are all, you know, deserved and on the up and up. But it's the peace and sometimes the literature prize, but often that's okay too. It's basically the peace prize they seem to be messing with.
Especially political. I'm starting to read about this Who's Afraid of Elie Wiesel. Was the name of the play actually Imagining Madoff, featuring Bernie Madoff,
yes,
Elie Wiesel, and his secretary that
yes,
he threatened would never reach the stage? Has it ever made it to the stage?
No. The story tells you how they caved in because he didn't nicely say, please don't do it. He said, you better not do it.
And
you'll see my lawyers. But they rewrote it. And they didn't put anything. They put something else on with different people, different characters. Oh, or maybe it was still Bernie Madoff and someone else. Yeah, it was Bernie. They put another play on out, not in Boston or in Washington, D.C., but out in the outskirts somewhere where they also put their plays. And it was had a different title, I think, and I forget now. I haven't read it for a while. And it was Bernie Madoff and some fictional rabbi who was active in Jewish affairs or something like that. And so that's how they did this.
Let me ask you this, Carolyn. I'm reading about the shadowy origins of night. I mean, how do you take 862 typewritten pages in Yiddish and reduce it to 120 pages in English? I mean, that's preposterous. I mean, the 120 pages would be like an appendix to an 862 page book. I mean, that's really...
Well, exactly.
I mean, that's very strange. And then I'm reading some of the descriptions about how he writes, and they're completely antithetical. He's got one where he's worrying over every sentence, every word, the meaning of the word "it," for example. And the other, he's writing in passion, eager to make sure he gets every page out. You know, he can't even stop and reread. I mean, these are completely different styles of writing. And I speak as
this
one.
This is the kind of. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
I speak as one who has written books at five different levels of complexity. So, you know, I mean, I realize, you know, the very great difference that can affect the way in which you write. But my style wouldn't undergo this kind of transformation.
Well, he's also saying he's describing the same, writing the same book in these two different ways. So
yeah.
This is where it's really crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, he's writing the same manuscript. So
this is disturbing.
Well, this is where this is what you find with all of this. You know, I have gone to the trouble to look all this up, and you find that it's there. I mean, what isn't there? There's a very little there, but nobody ever All these respectable or respected critics, you know, literary critics and so on, Jewish studies people and so on, have done all this reviews and critiques of Elie Wiesel's work. And only one or two have come close to looking at some of these issues, but they don't go very far with it. And so I looked into this, and it didn't really take that long. And this, I came up with this, and it's just that it's the failure of this man to live up to his legend is so incredible, and yet it's just ignored. You know, they just How many people will he pay attention to what's written here? Well, you know, see, none of them will get just silence.
Let me mention three points that disturb me. The first is he's asked about the tattoo. What could be simpler than to show it?
Exactly.
What could be simpler than to show it? Student asked, do you still have your tattoo? You raise your arm and you show it. You don't say, I still have it on my arm, and say the number. You actually show it. So that is very troubling. Then you have this idea of this play, Who's Afraid of Elie Wiesel? Now, it's a suppression of thought and creativity to not allow a production to be even performed. I mean, look, they're taking an interest in him. Why should he be opposed to it? If he's the real deal, is just as I have observed about the Holocaust. If the Holocaust is the real deal, then, you know, investigate it all you want. You're eventually going to be drawn to the conclusion that it was a reality, if indeed it actually occurred, as we have been taught. And if it wasn't, if it isn't vindicated by research, then we all deserve to know. Same with Elie Wiesel. So the fact that he's taken steps to suppress this production, I find that very troubling all by itself.
That was because he didn't want to be associated, so he says, with Bernie Madoff. And, you know, he lost money to Bernie Madoff. And there's questions about all these people who were investing with Bernie Madoff, and why they were, knowing that he was getting returns that really weren't, you know, average returns. They were much above average, but they didn't care about that as long as they were getting
them. That's an absurd.
This doesn't go too well with Elie Wiesel's.
Carolyn, that's an absurd attitude to adopt. He doesn't want to be associated with Bernard Madoff. He's already associated with Bernard Madoff.
Right.
He was an investor with Bernard Madoff.
Not only his foundation had millions with Madoff, but he personally had millions with Madoff, and he doesn't want to. He's so upset about losing it that he doesn't want to talk about it.
So that's very disturbing. And then, as you point out, you know, if he's got two different descriptions of the way in which he wrote the same book, you know, the completely different styles of writing and so forth, that is just calamitous.
Well, you find this throughout Elie Wiesel's writings and statements and so on. Contradictions. And they don't bother him. And you find this also, Dr. Fetzer, in all Holocaust survivor literature. And they don't bother anybody because nobody can do anything about it. I mean, you know, nobody can take them to court. Nobody can question them. Nobody can bring it up. And nobody knows about it.
I mean, if what you're saying is true, then Elie Wiesel is some kind of op.
Yes.
I mean, you know, he's a functionary for the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a political agenda. He, for God's sake, he might even be Mossad.
you said it.
I mean, it follows if these things we're talking about are well founded, and it seems obvious that the 3 points that I said have struck me are well-founded, because he could so easily show his tattoo, and he doesn't. He has no good reason to attack the play, yet he does. And the idea of having written the same book in two completely different, one a frenzied, you know, just kind of like a hurricane-style production,
right,
and the other very measured and sedate and deliberate. I mean, those can't both be true. So if he's saying the same thing about the one book, you know, unless, of course, one could argue, well, parts of the book he wrote in a hurry, and other parts he wrote at great leisure.
No,
it doesn't sound consistent.
Plus, he was on this in his memoir. he's talking about all kinds of things, and then he's going on this trip to Brazil for a journal for his newspaper as a journalist. And then he, in one paragraph, he says, well, during the trip, I was down in my, stayed in my cabin, and I decided to write my camp experience, which he had made a big deal about waiting 10 years. He made a vow to, so he could speak for the dead and speak for the silent ones and speak for this. And then he just, in one paragraph in this book, he says, I was down in my cabin writing frenziedly. I typed 862 pages because that is what was given to this publisher in Argentina. That is has been a known fact for some time. So, of course, he wrote this book in 95, I think. And he says, I when I was done, just in time for us to land there, and but I couldn't get off the boat. And then this publisher, that he never thought of anything about publishing it yet, this publisher just happens to come on board while he's being held there, and he's talking to him, and he sees he's holding this package, you know, this manuscript, he says, which he wouldn't be parted from. And he says, what is that? And Weasel says, oh, it's, you know, I've written my story of my concentration camp experience. And he says, oh, can I see it? And he says, well, it's not finished yet. He says, well, I still want to look at it. So he looked at it. He said, well, can I take this, you know, and I might publish it. And Weasel didn't want to let him have it, but he did. And this is all in one paragraph. I mean, this is all it took.
And this is the one and this is the one and only copy of the.
The one and only copy. And a reader pointed out to me that since he said he was typing it on his little portable, and you know, another thing about Elie Wiesel is that he makes it. He said many times that he writes all his books in longhand. He's never written on a typewriter or a computer. He writes in longhand. But this one, of course, he was a journalist. He was in his cabin. He was writing it on this little portable typewriter. And he managed to type up 862 pages. And it couldn't have been more than 2 weeks. He said he was going to be gone for 6 weeks. So if he was going to go and come back, you know, and be there for a while, I figure maybe, I don't know how long it takes that boat then to get to Brazil. But 2 weeks max. I don't think.
2 weeks.
Typing in a frenzy.
So we're talking about, say, 15 days. I on a good day when I have written some of my books, I might write 15 pages.
Yeah.
15 pages times 15 is not going to get us to 862.
No, none of it. None of it adds up. Nothing adds up. But, you know, it's like when it comes to somebody like Elie Wiesel and his stories, of course, I'm going to say this anyway. You have to have absolute proof. What would it be? Some person that comes up and says, I wrote that, and here's when I did it, and has witnesses and proof of all kind, and then maybe you could get people to listen to you. But well, even when they have brought proof about things, you know, like we were talking earlier about the walls of the alleged gas chambers and so on, even when proof is brought, it's dismissed.
Well, I know enough about author's vanity to know that if you got an 862 typewritten manuscript, you're not going to allow it to be reduced to 120 pages. You're going to have too much concern for everything else that's missing. I mean, what's missing is 742 pages.
Well, he says now that what's missing is more important than what's there, and it speaks more loudly. You know, Elie Wiesel talks in riddles.
So why wasn't it published? Why hasn't it been published?
Because it's lost.
It's lost.
It's
lost. You mean the publisher took it and all he did was publish the 120 pages? And
No, that's the 120 pages in English. The publisher published 245 pages in Yiddish.
Yes.
He was a Yiddish publisher.
Yes.
In Argentina.
Yes.
And in this, he had a whole series. This man had over 100 stories from various survivors of World War II.
And okay, so he was specializing.
This was one of them.
He
published this in Yiddish, and then Elie Wiesel says that then he reduced it further to about 170 or so pages and gave it to François Mauriac, his French friend, who is also a Nobel Prize who was promoting him as a... He, who is encouraging him to write these memoirs. Well, that whole story is also full of errors and inconsistencies, which I don't think we can go into right now. But so none of it, the whole thing is botched up, which is why this is only part one, and I'm going to write part two and probably have a part three. Just on the story of this.
This is just baffling. I'm just completely blown away. I mean, this is bizarre. And why he wouldn't simply show his tattoo is just beyond belief. I mean, you know, he's got to whip it out and display it. I mean, he never has. That's ridiculous.
It is. Which is why we make that the basis of the whole challenge. We call this our Elie Wiesel challenge, and the basis of it is the tattoo, because, as you say, it's just the simplest thing in the world. All he has to do is show it, but he doesn't have one. And people say, oh, he'll go to a tattoo artist, and they'll put that on there, and then what are you going to do? And I say, oh, you know, I don't think he's going to do that, because the number A7713, we have all this other proof under the evidence on our menu bar that shows that this number belonged to a different person. And also, Dr. Fetzer, Elie Wiesel says he was in Auschwitz and Buchenwald with his father, Shlomo, from the beginning. And his father died at Buchenwald in February. And his father's number was A7712. Yet this number, A7712, belonged to the brother, the older brother of the man who had A7713. And there is no record of Shlomo Wiesel or Elie Wiesel with his birth date at Auschwitz or Buchenwald. The only record they have is of Eleazar Wiesel, which is the same name as his, but with a very different birth date. So, and all these Jewish people are going along with this story and trying to, hold it up, and keep it together. And they're getting, making themselves, and one of them is Ken Walzer, who is a professor at, University of, where is he? In Wisconsin? No, it doesn't come to my mind, but somewhere like that.
What's his name? I'll do a Google.
Ken Walzer.
M-A-L-T?
No. W-A-L-Z-E-R. W-A-L-T-Z-E-R. Well, I have it right here.
Ken Walzer, American historian professor, current director of Jewish studies at Michigan State.
Michigan State, okay.
Yeah. He's done work on Buchenwald.
He's writing a book. Yes. He's writing a book about the orphans of Buchenwald, which Elie Wiesel is supposedly one. And he's got all these, he claims Elie Wiesel is in a picture, you know, leaving Buchenwald as a young boy. And I've got a page.
Oh, he's writing a book that's going to substantiate Elie Wiesel's story?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, they all do.
Very
this is why I have the, this is why I say a lot of the things I do, because I know that they're all conspiring to hold together lies, and you can't call it anything else. They think they can say all they want, well, it's for a good cause. That's what they'll say. If they ever really get caught red-handed and have to admit what they're doing, they'll say, well, it was for a good cause. You know Simon Wiesenthal?
Yes.
He died not too long ago. In his horrible Nazi hunter center, where they're still going after these old 90-year-old guys and trying to, put them on trial. And he's, what's I going to say here now? A book came out by a reputable historian, which showed, and they admitted in there, that he had lied about so many things, just like Elie Wiesel, lied about so many things. But then this author, and the press and everybody, they say, well, but he did it in a good cause. He was.
Oh, I love it.
That nobody else was doing. He was bringing. He was
the end justifies.
Who were hiding around somewhere here and there, and so we overlook these faults of his. But I mean, he's destroyed people's lives over and over and over again with his lies, and so you can't overlook it. Anyway,
and the one we're speaking of now, who's destroyed people with their lies, is who?
Well, Elie Wiesel has not destroyed people's lives to the extent that Simon Wiesenthal has.
Simon Wiesenthal.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this, speaking of philosophy and these types of questions. Elie Wiesel is a professor of philosophy at Boston University, and he holds a chair, a Mellon chair in humanities. What do you think of their choice of him, and what kind of a philosophy teacher do you think he would be?
This is all very troubling to me, because if you're right, Carolyn, about your indictment of Elie Wiesel in relation to the tattoo, the book, the attack on the play, then he's a fraud. He's a fundamentally a dishonest person. If all of that is true, he's a fraud. And, you know, philosophy, like good philosophy, good science, requires a profound dedication to honesty. It tests your integrity. You have to be willing to follow an argument where it leads based upon the evidence, and the principles are non-arbitrary. So you don't always have a lot of choices about where you begin and where you end in relation to where you begin in the principles of reasoning. In fact, it's a feature of the objectivity of science, not that every scientist has the same background or upbringing or beliefs, etc., in general, but rather that every scientist confronted with the same evidence, the same range of alternative mm-hmm. hypotheses, and the same rules of reasoning is going to arrive at the same conclusions as to which hypotheses are acceptable, which are rejectable, and which should be left in suspense. And I'm just very troubled by what you're telling me about.
Well, go to, on our menu, on our Wiesel tattoo page, on the menu bar, we have projects, and under that we have Boston University. And if you click there, you will see that we have a project to write to the faculty of the Department of Philosophy at Boston University, giving them this information about Elie Wiesel. Wow. And what do you think is going to happen there? What's your opinion of this project first? You think it's wrong of us to bother these people?
Well, it would probably be better to write to the president than it would be to the department.
There's nothing they can do.
There's a hierarchy. You know, you got departments that have chairmen or heads, and then you have deans over
he's
the departments.
On there. The chairman's on there, and all those people. Yes.
I know several faculty at Boston University. This is very.
What do you think their response will be? I think they're going to just
very troubling. Very troubling.
But I hope
Well, the faculty will probably leave it up to the administration, right? In other words, the faculty members. I'll tell you one thing about faculty I discovered in 35 years. There's nothing faculty fear more than embarrassment. They fear more being embarrassed than anything else. So this is why most faculty don't take strong stands on complex and controversial issues unless they've done their homework. And of course, you know, I mean, I buy into that. I mean, I do it, but I've done my homework. And I wouldn't do it if I hadn't done my homework. And most of them simply aren't motivated to tackle issues.
They certainly wouldn't be. Their career would be at stake.
Well,
but the fact is, if we do send this to them, if people send this to them, they won't say anything publicly, but they might talk among themselves, or they might talk to themselves or something, you know. But you're right, it is the dean and the president of the university and so on that we need.
Well, you could always send it to the president with copies to the dean and to the chairman of the department. I mean, that would be a way to do it, cover all the bases, and then everyone knows that there's an issue here. Whether they do anything about it is a whole other matter, because it's going to be viewed politically. They're mm-hmm. going to say, you know, that's the way the administrators think. They're going to be thinking politically. They're going to say, well, is this going to help BU in its fundraising if we expose Elie Wiesel as a fraud? Or is it going to harm BU in its fundraising if we expose Elie Wiesel as a fraud? Assuming he is a fraud, you know, and of course that's a matter that would require investigation. But certainly BU would be in the position to undertake it easier than anyone else, you know. I mean, if the dean walks in and asks Elie to show him his tattoo, I don't think Elie Wiesel is going to be in the position to refuse.
No, that would be wonderful, wouldn't it? Well, that's why we're sort of going after everyone here, because we don't know, you know, who.
I'll tell you, that's who you should write, or alternatively, you could write to the Board of Regents or the Board of Trustees.
Mm-hmm.
You want to do so in a very diplomatic fashion. You'd want to say something like, we have long admired the tradition of Boston University and the support it's given for the humanities and so forth, where one of the most striking, politically conspicuous members of your faculty is Elie Wiesel. And, of course, he is generally associated with a host of worthy, even noble causes, even, of course, including being the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. And that we're writing simply to say that there's some issues here in relation to Professor Wiesel that bother us. One is, and then you talk about that tattoo. Another is, and you talk about the play. Another is, and you talk about the book. And you just say, we realize that this is not our responsibility, but rather yours in maintaining the integrity of your faculty and so forth, but that we thought it would be our obligation to bring this information to your attention, that you should take whatever action you believe might be most appropriate.
Very good. Thank you.
That's how you do it.
I like that.
And you can send it to the chairman of the Board of Trustees and the president of the university and the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, whichever Elie is in. There may be a separate College of Arts and a separate College of Sciences, and then the head of the department. That's how you would do it if you want to do it the right way, Carol.
Okay. All right. I thank you for that.
And then let us know, what comes about. I've really enjoyed having you on for a discussion of a whole lot of topics that aren't often addressed for a whole lot of reasons, most of which are political and not really very good reasons. But I think to gain intellectual clarity, you have to be able to kick around ideas from all points of view. And I thought with regard to the issues we were addressing today that we were doing a pretty good job of it.
Yeah, we kicked around pretty good. I want to tell you that I enjoyed it immensely. I thank you for asking me to be on, and I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Well, Carolyn, I'd be glad to have you back. We'll do it again, okay? Thank you so very, very much, and I encourage everyone to tune in to your radio show. And I imagine they can track it down too, Carolyn, by entering your name on Google.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay. Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, Carolyn Yeager, for being with me today, and to all of you for listening.